You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and following up on last week's show when we hosted Iowa Speaker of the House, Pat Grassley, who talked about the recently completed session in the General Assembly in Iowa and gave his thoughts on that. Today, we're going to follow up and have his rival, the Democratic leader of the Iowa House, Todd Pritchard, to talk about the session from his perspective, his party's perspective, and just to give equal time and kind of balance things out. Todd Pritchard was first elected in his seat, the 52nd House District, up in the north central part of the state. Charles City is where Todd's from. And by the way, he was originally from Davenport, so he knows this area, the Quad City area, pretty well. Todd, thank you so much for being my guest today.
No, always good to talk to you, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
I always like your description of yourself, by the way. You describe yourself as a country lawyer, and I think that's something that appeals to everybody these days.
Well, it's true. Charles City in this part of the state is a pretty rural part of the state, and I am a lawyer, so they both adjectives work.
Well, what would be your, general take on the session? Again, you're a leader of the oil opposition, and it's going to be a different one, obviously, than the speaker had. But what's your take overall on how the legislature did?
Yeah, no, I think, I would call Pat Grassley, Speaker Grassley, my counterpart, more than a rival, even though we are a bit competitive in terms of agendas. But, with this past legislative session, I think we failed to grasp the issue of the day, and that's COVID. The Republicans, with Governor Reynolds' leadership, took a pretty partisan turn or approach towards the legislature and the legislative agenda. There was really nothing that I can think of any significance that addressed COVID in a comprehensive or significant, impactful way. And to me, that's really a dereliction of duty of our state leadership in a time of pandemic. We have a lot of people, and I hear from a lot of my constituents and see it around the state, the people that are displaced from their job and so they're not working. Or maybe they are a hairdresser or in childcare, or they're in some sort of industry that was impacted by COVID, and a lot of industries were impacted by COVID, the restaurant industry and service industries and things like that. Here we have this massive disruption and really nothing by way of an assistance package from our legislative session. And I think, to me, that's dereliction. And I wish there's so much that we could have done that I think would have been impactful to help us get through COVID, get the economy back on track in terms of getting people back into the workplace, getting small businesses back fully opening, and then, just strengthen our economy generally. I think we could have recovered in a stronger fashion than what we went into this.
Were there other programs you're thinking of aside the ones that, like, the federal government had some programs to help businesses directly, or were those kind of gone through the state government to be implemented? I mean, what other specifics do you think they should have done?
Well, I think the first thing is, like, why our governor turned away federal support for Iowans affected with unemployment benefits. It makes zero sense. That made absolutely zero sense to me. It was taking money out of our economy. I get the counter argument. It's like, oh, we're incentivizing people not to work. I just do not accept that. That is a significant, effect of this, the federal unemployment supplement. It was keeping people afloat from people that I've talked to and people that I've heard from. And it's taking money out of the economy. So I think that's going to make it's going to, you know, people who aren't working, who are displaced, who are having trouble, you know, keeping up on the rent, who are behind on the rent, that just puts them in a bigger hole. And so that's one decision that was primarily the governor's decision that I think was harmful. But, you know, in terms of what the legislature could have done, we should have had assistance for small business, kind of mirrored some programs, and targeted some state dollars, to help small businesses. We should have been more focused with schools in terms of helping schools with, keeping the schools safe so we could, you know, kind of return to learn. You know, the governor and the governor's approach to returning to learn was just basically, you're going back. And the governor actually, refused some federal assistance, for testing in the schools and things like that. So, you know, I think she was bragging about it on a national conservative, network about how she was refusing, aid dollars. That's not helpful. You know, I mean, I don't know what that helps other than just, you know, maybe it makes a good headline or something, in certain circles, but, you know, that's not keeping Iowans safe. It's not helping us recover. It's not getting us back to normal. And that's really what we should have been focused on, is just targeted assistance and help for people and organizations that were impacted by the pandemic.
Do you think the Iowa economy's recovered? There's some evidence across the country that we're getting close to being back to where we were. What's your sense up in your neck of the woods and statewide as well? Is the economy back, you think, pretty much where it was before COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're close. I mean, there still is. You know, I think as long as you've got people who are choosing not to participate, maybe they're not going out to eat, maybe they're not going on a trip, you know, or they're not going to the store because, you know, they're worried about COVID and things like that. As long as there's still kind of that anxiety, I think, amongst people, we're not going to be fully back to where we could be or should be. And so, you know, are we getting there? Yeah, I think we're close. And I think a lot of that, I give a lot of credit to that for the national push for vaccines. You know, we're about 60% of people that are fully vaccinated. And, you know, that's great. I mean, that's really been an effort in Iowa that I credit the Biden administration for pushing that. And so, you know, I think that really is the key to return to normalcy, is when we get just people comfortable going about, usual tasks in their daily lives.
Well, before we get to some of the specific topics that we'll go through on the session, I kind of wanted to take our listeners inside, you know, maybe the strategy as a leader of the loyal opposition here. You're in the minority. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you'd rather be in the majority, but you're not. And you've got to rally your caucus around some type of strategy for dealing with the majority's agenda. How do you do that? I mean, do you solicit all your members on what their priorities are and try to come up with your own legislative package? Do you reach out to try to compromise and amend what the majority does? What's kind of the strategy you adopt going into these sessions?
No, we do both of those things. You know, we try to come up with our own agenda, and so we do a lot of kind of brainstorming sessions and group discussions about where we want to be on the issues and articulate our positions. And so there's very much you know, consensus building within our caucus as far as the issues that we want to be advocates for and the positions that we want to take. And then, you know, then that turns into legislative action, whether it's in the form of bills that are filed, whether it's in the form of amending of legislation introduced by the governor, you know, offering our amendments. But, you know, really the first step that I take with my caucus and you know, the speech that I give or the lines that I give to my caucus when I start these types of things is I say, listen, we want the state to be successful. And, you know, it's kind of an old adage. Somebody once told me that good policy is good politics. And that's kind of my starting point, is that I'm not there to be obstructionist just for the fact that, you know, we can be obstructionist in some fashion and try to block an agenda. You know, we're going to work if we think that an agenda or an item is going to move the state forward. We're going to support it. I will give bipartisan victories where they align with my values and the values of my caucus, and they're going to be helpful to the people. I'm not there to just to say no for the sake of being a contrarian. And so, you know, we do have some bipartisan victories. We didn't have what I would call large bipartisan victories this year. We had a handful with some topics like important things like child care, but not what I would call wholesale. We had probably the biggest bipartisan victory that I thought was maybe the most far-reaching was a year ago, last June, when we came in to finish our session after taking a couple of months off because of the pandemic, pausing the session. We came back to finish, and we passed a consensus legislation and with what we call the More Perfect Union, which dealt with police reform and social justice reforms that everybody could get behind. And I think a very important discussion, very important step for Iowa to make sure that we are a socially justice conscious society and state, and our laws reflect that. But then also ensuring that our police forces in the state are trained, and that we have the right people wearing the uniform and carrying the badge.
Well, the speaker, and I don't want to be unfair to him because he isn't here to defend himself. But one of the things he talked about that he was proud of was some legislation dealing with protections for police officers, and specifically on protest related crimes. Was that a bill this session that had bipartisan support, or how did you view that legislation?
Yeah, it had a couple of Democratic votes. I think for many of us, that legislation was not what I would call consensus. It really had some issues from a First Amendment free speech standpoint. And, I think, we'll see what happens with that legislation in terms of how it's applied. But, I have some real concerns about its ability to be overreach. I used to be a prosecutor. And, you want your prosecutors, one, you need to trust prosecutors. There is prosecutorial discretion. But at the same time, you need to couch that with saying, there are limits to what can be prosecuted and protections for the public, so that we're not worried about overzealous prosecution. And, some of the things in that legislation, I think, really opened the door for overzealous prosecution. Things that would not be criminal could be criminal in a lot of people's minds. And that, to me, crosses the line. The other thing, speaking about that package of legislation, in Iowa, we had a tragedy earlier this year with two murders at Anamosa State Penitentiary in Anamosa, Iowa, which is not too far from the Quad Cities, just a little north and a little west. And, some real failures in the prison system in terms of funding and staffing that I think the investigation will probably conclude were contributing factors. We'll see. I don't want to speak too authoritatively on that, but we'll see what the investigation says. But I think there are some issues, and I think there are some amendments that we offered in terms of providing workplace protections, workplace safety, and bargaining for correctional officers who work in the penitentiary system. These are public safety workers, and this incident was really eye-opening. We had two people murdered. You had two inmates who were trying to escape, and who knows what they would have done. You hate to think what could have happened if they actually made it out and got into the community.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is House Democratic Leader Todd Pritchard from Charles City up in north central Iowa. We've been talking a little bit about the just-completed Iowa legislative session from his standpoint as the Democratic leader in the House of Representatives, and, in contrast to Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley, my guest last week, who spoke about the session from the majority standpoint. I'm curious, One of the big issues that we're seeing right now nationally, and I think in Iowa, is the challenge of matching up employees with open spots in the workforce. There's different theories on why that is, but did the legislature take sufficient action, in your opinion, to address that this session?
No, absolutely not. I think in Iowa we took a step backwards in creating an environment or a culture of openness. There was some legislation introduced. Some of it passed that I think will be harmful for attracting what you'd call the best and brightest people to our state. You know, Iowa is a really unique state, and I think we've got a really sophisticated economy, really sophisticated employers that for the businesses and jobs that are located here. I mean, working at John Deere is not what it was 70 years ago. You need people with some specific skills to work in the industry. If you look at my town of Little Charles City, Iowa, a town of 8,000 people that has two pharmaceutical plants that have a very sophisticated and complicated manufacturing process here. We have a shortage of chemists. We have a shortage of biochemists. But we also have a shortage of what I would consider skilled or semi-skilled production workers. I mean, there's a real need here. And then you look at the financial industry in Des Moines and other parts of the state as well. I mean, the economy that we want to build, that we have done a good job building over the decades in Iowa, really requires sophisticated, educated workers. And we have that workforce supply here. We have people with our, as long as we keep our education system, vibrant. But, you know, the other end of this too is we need to import workers. We need to attract people from outside of Iowa to want to live in Iowa. And so, you know, with some of the things that the agenda, what I would call a partisan agenda that was passed in terms of the divisive issues legislation that was passed that basically said that, you know, it's kind of a chilling effect on discussions about diversity training in our education system. When you talk, when you introduce bills and you have rhetoric around transgender children, and those types of things, you know, the bathroom bill, the list goes on. I would put the voting, the unnecessary voter suppression bill that we saw here in Iowa that are kind of been part of a national trend in Republican states to what I would say is make it more difficult for people, for elderly people, poor people, minority populations to vote. This is not the message that we want to send to the rest of the world about what is, you know, about the quality of life and the opportunities here in Iowa. Another thing that not a legislative issue, but an executive branch, Governor Reynolds' decision is refusing to take children who are stranded or kind of in a refugee status. That was really sad. Here we have an opportunity to do something positive for people, and we chose not to. The Statue of Liberty, I think, has been a symbol of our country because it stands for this light for the downtrodden, and I hate the message that some of these priorities sent to what it means to live in Iowa.
You know, you mentioned school funding. I'm going to unpack a couple things here. You referred to school funding, both K through 12 and college and university funding. How do you feel the state did in investing in schools? Because, as you said, everybody agrees that any type of future economic advancement is going to be heavily dependent on training not only in the schools, but also retraining in for the workforce?
Yeah, the short answer is we did horrible on school funding this year for two reasons. One, we're not keeping up with inflation for the state's contribution to schools, to school districts across the state. So we're actually, you're not keeping up with inflation. You're actually kind of defunding your schools. And that's been happening now for quite a few years. That puts a burden shift for funding requirements to the local level, because local districts like where I live in Charles City, when they don't get the funding from a school, you know, we don't want to lose programs in our school. Our school is the community hub. It's the center of gravity for the community. And we don't want to lose the quality that we have. So what happens is property taxes go up because we're not getting the money from the state to have the band program or have foreign language or have the music and other maybe sports activities or build a new addition. The state has just not been a contributing partner like they should. The other thing that we did, the second thing besides just, you know, continued trend of inadequate funding and commitment from the state, is we passed this a charter school bill, which I think will be a bigger diversion of public dollars to basically private type school institutions with very little oversight from the local community and from the State Department of Education. And so I am really concerned. You know, I talked to a lot of my Republican colleagues who say they support public education. I said, "Well, aren't you worried about this legislation having a negative impact and really drawing dollars away from public schools?" And they're like, "Oh, this, you know, I don't think this is going to be that big an impact." I hope they're right, but it certainly opens the door for charter schools to come into the state and divert a lot of money into what would basically be, you know, a kind of a for-profit type situation, even though I know they're supposed to be nonprofit organizations. You look at how some nonprofits have structured salaries and kind of question that. And I really think we may have opened the door, and I hope not, but we'll see how that goes. You know, but generally, I'll say this, you know, as a Davenport, as a West End kid who grew up in the West End of Davenport, and now somebody who's raised my family and works and lives and works in a rural part of the state, you know, just what I said is absolutely true. I think it was true in Davenport, you know, that the community center of gravity is your school. And if you want to have jobs, particularly in rural areas, you've got to have a workforce. And you've got to have a workforce that has the skills to work these jobs. I mentioned we have two pharmaceutical plants here. If you want to come in and be a production worker, you know, basically with a high school degree, you can do that. You can earn a great living, but that high school degree has got to give you certain skills in terms of basic math and literacy skills. And so we need to make sure, you know, that we have the education system that supports the jobs that we want to attract in Iowa. And so you're going to, you know, if you do that, if you're willing to make the investment in your education, they'll come. The jobs will come. The old Field of Dreams thing. If you build it, they will come. If you build a high-quality education system, the jobs will flow. You know, that's really what drives my my arguments in the legislature for why education funding is so critical, because it's going to drive our economy.
The other topic you mentioned there was the election reform bill, and you it's a pretty harsh term described it as voter suppression. Can you point out specific items in that legislation that justify the use of that term?
Yeah, no, I definitely can. And I think the one thing, you know, is you've got these limitations on getting your ballot to, like, say you vote absentee ballot, getting your ballot to the polls. You can't give it to somebody to drop off. The other thing is it limits the amount of time you have for in-person voting on the day of the election. It rolls that back by about an hour, which may not seem like a big deal. You know, we're losing an hour of the polls being open. It is a big deal. Voting is absolutely essential. And, you know, a lot of people work two jobs, or they work a late shift, and for them to get in and find time in the day, it's sometimes a struggle to go and vote. And so, you know, our position has always been make it easier to vote. Make it more accessible. You know, we took an hour away of the polls being open on election day. We closed the window or the number of days that you can vote in person early. We rolled those back for no reason. for absolutely no reason. There's just zero justification for this bill. The only impact that this legislation is going to have is it's going to make it harder to vote. And when you make it harder to do something, you know, on a process, you know, across a system, you're going to have fewer people that are able to access it. And so, you know, maybe it's just on the margins. Like, well, we're going to have 0.5% people that can't, you know, or lower voter turnout. You know, maybe it's only a few thousand people. Well, the second congressional district vote was election was decided by 6 votes. Votes matter. And, you know, and I also talk about this. I'm an Iraq War veteran. I've been serving in the Army continually since 1996 to this day. And if there's one thing I get passionate about, it's voting rights. This is how we protect our democracy. And passing legislation for no apparent, justifiable, articulable reason that is only going to have the impact of limiting people's access to the ballot box is voter suppression.
We only have time for about one more question, about a minute here. Recently, you announced you were going to step down from your position as the House Democratic leader. Could you share kind of your reasoning behind that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's a hard decision. It's been a job that I have absolutely enjoyed. It's a lot of hours. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of time away from your family and away from your job and things like that. But it's a great job interacting with people from across the state. And being an advocate for progressive ideas and you know, as you say, being the loyal minority, which I is a role that I think is very important. And so, you know, but we in Iowa and most state legislators are civilian, we're citizen legislators. And so I have a small business that I run, a law firm that I run, and then I've got other commitments. I'm in the Army Reserve. And so, it takes a lot of time to be the minority leader. And so after 3 years, I felt that, one, the time commitment was taking a toll on my family and on my business. And so there are other people in the legislature, in my caucus who can step up and will step up and, carry this forward. I will continue to serve. You know, I'll finish out my term for sure and, continue to be a voice for my part of the state, my district.
Oh. Well, I appreciate your service as I do Speaker Grassley last week. It's more and more challenging to serve in government these days with all the vitriol that's expressed on social media and et cetera. So I salute all of you that serve and thank you again for being my guest today. You've been on my show several times and I do appreciate it. Enjoy talking with you. My guest today has been Iowa House Democratic Leader Todd Pritchard from Charles City. And Todd, thank you again for being on the show, and good luck, and I hope to have you back.
No, I hope to be back. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Robin.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at wvik.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.